Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is writer Joanna Howard, currently a teacher in creative writing at Denver University. She grew up in Miami, Oklahoma in the late 70s and 80s and is the author of a novel titled Foreign Correspondent, the story collections On the Winding Stair and In the Colorless Round, and Field Glass, a speculative fiction collaborative novel written with Joanna Ruoco. Her latest book, though, is a nonfiction account of her preschool days and early home life in northeastern Oklahoma, where television was as much a part of the family as her truck-driving father, her Ms. Magazine-reading mother, and her skateboarding and bull-riding brother. With family debates over who was the better deputy on Gunsmoke, Festus or Joplin native Dennis Weaver's Chester, how shows like Hee Haw, Andy Griffith, the Beverly Hillbillies, and Westerns were constant companions, then with the rural purge in television, gone like that. Rerun Era is a memory memoir, hilariously written, but there's a sense of unease in the laughter, which only becomes apparent as the family dynamics collapse, as does the health of her beloved father. Joanna Howard will be in Tulsa Monday evening to discuss her book in a Magic City Booksmart Tulsa event at Duet Restaurant and Jazz Club, Monday evening at 7 o'clock. Her book, Rerun Era, or The Dislocation, is published by McSweeney's. Joanna Howard, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, thanks, Rich. Thanks for having me.
A Rerun Era is a really interesting book. It's kind of an audacious book of doing a memory memoir of your earliest experiences in childhood, almost toddler years. What led you to explore this part of your life?
I think because 1980, when I was five, was a really important year in my family. My dad had some health problems, and we were kind of trying to reconfigure how the world was going to look. And so it's really crystal in my mind, even though, like a lot of other stuff, is fuzzy. As you say, I was very, very young. But so the goal of the book was just to kind of go back and sort out some of the fuzzy stuff around some of the stuff that seemed to me like really crystal clear that I've been holding on to for, you know, like, well, I'm in my 40s now, so for a while.
Mm-hmm. When I think about those periods in my life, I think of little, almost like small little videos. They're larger than photographs, but they're just these sort of visceral moments from that era, like a 5-second loop or something. How did you go about and reconstruct these memories?
Well, it's exactly that. I mean, I think you nailed it. Actually, the loop was the thing that really pushed the book forward in my mind. I would go back and watch, like, on YouTube, little tiny clips from television or like tiny clips from like the beginning of cartoons that I watched. And I would just put them on repeat because it was like the same exact feeling of capturing those memories of like being in my parents' bedroom or something for a moment and not knowing how to locate what was going on around it. And so I just went into it and thought about that. That's why the book is kind of like broken up into tiny pieces with like section titles. It's like kind of unconventional, I think, for a memoir to do that. But it's exactly because of the reason you say.
And, of course, the first part of the book, you know, for a toddler, especially in that era, I'm a little older than you, but, you know, in the 60s and 70s, television was sort of this ubiquitous family member.
Yeah, totally.
And this is a big part of the early part of the book, as how you sort of reconnect with some of these memories.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Now that the book is out, like I'm talking to a lot of people like you that have similar feelings about this period in television, and I think that it's been really helpful to hear that just because sometimes I feel like the people I saw on television were like parts of my family. We were all so invested in these narratives, like in sitcoms, which were not super realistic or not necessarily representative of the world per se, but we were really invested in those characters and those stories, and we all came together to watch those things because it was like back in the day when you didn't have like your separate little individual cell that you watched on. Like everyone, you know, there was like, we didn't have more than one television. We just had to like all come together. And even though everyone in my family had very different views about the world, we sat there together and watched stuff on television. So it was like a place in which the family was kind of unified. I mean, I imagine other kinds of families did things like play games together or something. I don't know. My family just sat in front of the TV pretty much all the time.
And it's three channels, one television, negotiate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And live with
it. Yeah, the rabbit ears and the antennas and the whole nine yards.
Now, did you grow up in a rural area? Now, you grew up in Miami. But was it a rural area? Because when you're outside of the town, I think in many ways as a young child, you're even a little more isolated because you can't really go running off into the woods when you're 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. And that television is sort of like the main entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. I grew up on the very edge of Miami, kind of like on the side of Miami that's closest to like Pitcher, Oklahoma. And I guess like my grandfather, he died before I was around on my mother's side, but he had worked at the municipal airport. So we grew up like basically kind of on the grounds of the municipal airport, which is just surrounded by fields and mostly like Milo fields. And there were like, you know, I was surrounded by like a trash incinerator and some fields. And then this municipal airport that, you know, kind of would have like one plane a week or something coming into it. So it was pretty isolated. There weren't a lot of like woods to escape to because it was really just these, you know, empty flat spaces.
What I found interesting is your description as a five-year-old describing your universe, which is Miami, a place that floods every year.
Yeah.
Three parts of the town, mainly because Grand Lake needed water for water skiing, and so waters would back up, and when it would rain, it would flood. A place where you went to Joplin for everything, and of course Tar Creek running through with its blood red water.
Yeah, it's sort of it's an environmentally devastated area. Pitcher itself is a Superfund site. They basically relocated the whole town if people were willing to go, and you know it's. A lot of people weren't willing to go because it's really hard to just imagine after you've lived there for multiple generations where you would go. The cleanups have been, you know, pretty significant. Tar Creek, which was blood red when I grew up from iron oxide and other stuff that was pumping through the mines and Pitcher, is now like, looks kind of like creek-like. It's like basically the color of creek.
Sometimes. Sometimes.
Sometimes. Yeah, it kind of depends on what the weather's doing. And the flooding still happens, but not as dramatically. And I do think that, you know, I only have the narratives of that my family gave me. I know my dad really went to a lot of civic-type meetings when I was growing up, trying to figure out exactly why everything floods. And it was this sort of, you know, like a mystery the town was trying to solve. But somebody knew.
I love the five-year-old version of your story in which this place in the lake is this mysterious area, which is, I assume, it's the upper reaches of Grand Lake, right?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, my dad really wanted to live there. It was his dream. And it's like a dream, like, I don't know, I talk to people that are like, one day I'm going to go to Paris or something, but my dad's dream was to be on Grand Lake. And he was a fisherman, and he just really loved it there, and his sister lived there, and he just always wanted to be there. So there was this way in which that fantasy, which seemed so impossible to reach, even though it seems silly to me now because it was like 20 minutes away or something, and a lot of working class people did have places on the lake and around the lake, but for my family it was just this this like huge looming fantasy that one day we would get to the lake.
Rerun Era is this really interesting memoir, again a memory memoir of your very young childhood days. And we know we're on to a journey just from some of the chapter titles. The first chapter titles, there are pictures of Dennis Weaver at my favorite ice cream shop. Everything is a rerun or a variety. I learned my rhetoric from Hee Haw despite myself. And the one I'd like to talk about, Hoyt Axton is from Oklahoma and so is Roger Miller. And it sort of made me think of the family dynamic that you slowly unveil in the course of this memoir. And it made me think of, you know, there are sort of three types of people who grew up in Oklahoma. There are those that love it, love being outdoors, love the fishing and hunting, and, you know, and they stay here their entire lives. There are those who can't wait to leave. And there are those who want to leave, but for whatever reason, can't or don't. And I think in your family, there were all three types.
There definitely were all three types. And I think that there's like, and I would say about myself, like part of writing this book was me really trying to get back to a place where I could remember the really great times that I had in Oklahoma. I think it was actually super fun in many ways to grow up there because there were not a lot, there were just not a lot of oversight. Like we did a lot of things that people kind of let happen. And we did sort of run around on bicycles, you know, anywhere we wanted. And And there wasn't this sense of like the pressure to succeed in the way that I think like some places you grow up and people have their kids in like the private school at age 5 or something. There was none of that pressure. So I wanted to get back to some of the memories that were like the really great memories for me and to be able to both think, okay, yeah, I didn't want to stay there, but I also want to be able to love the place and go back to it and think about it in my mind that way.
Well, certainly your father was one that did love the place. He was a truck driver who wanted nothing more than to be a fishing boat guide on Grand Lake and have a place on Grand Lake. Your mother struck me as one of those people that wanted to leave, but for whatever reason couldn't. She was very different than your father. And in fact, I really wanted to read more about her. She seemed like a very conflicted person.
Definitely, yes, I would agree with that. And, you know, there was a moment when, before the book came out, I was thinking about that I was going to have to do a second part that was just about my mother, because there's too many strange coincidences in my father's narrative and my mother's narrative. But as you say, they were such different people. They really, it's been a kind of a mystery to me and my brother what held them in a relationship for so many years, just because they were so different. My mother, I think, did try to get out, and she tried to get my father out too. They had like this brief foray where they went to Utah, where my mother had like a brother living. And my dad did not like driving a truck in Utah. It was like snowy and there were mountains. And also he just missed his family. He missed the place he had grown up. And so they came back. And so I think that part of the narrative that doesn't kind of make it into the book, but is like that there was a part of my mother that resented that failed escape that she was trying to make and the return home.
And as you write, we were writing about television and how this was sort of your ubiquitous friend. It's for the family, you know, everything was inane. Cartoons, inane. Hee-haw, really, inane.
She really did write a letter about how stupid the Smurfs were to to like the Nielsen rating family things. It made it really hard to just enjoy stuff, I think, some of that attitude. And part of my life's work, I feel like, is to get the people around me to see that it's okay to enjoy things, and it's okay to watch something on television that seems kind of stupid. It's not going to be the end of the world. If you're watching Ewok cartoons or Smurf cartoons, which really was, like, to my mother, just a total crisis. She kind of wanted me to be, like, playing the piano and learning to play classical music. And I remember even my piano teachers would try to get me to, like, learn the theme song from Cheers, which was my dream. I just wanted to play the theme song from Cheers. And I was trying to learn it secretly with my piano teacher. And my mother found out, and she fired my piano teacher. It's pretty sad.
My guest today is Joanna Howard. She teaches at the Denver University in the Creative Writing PhD program there, and her latest book is titled Rerun Era or The Dislocation. It's published by McSweeney's. It's an account of her very young childhood memoir, and it's very, very funny. Although I have to tell you, Joanna, it's like I was really I was laughing out loud in the office as I was reading this book, but there was this sense of unease, and eventually that unease becomes apparent. But before we talk about that, I want to ask about one section. It's called The Problem with the Lookup. And you write, I am looking everything up like crazy. I'm scared I'm losing my memory of this place. I want to look it up and have it confirmed in my mind. Otherwise, you forget. Then I realize looking it up is what makes you forget. It just creates the memory. So tell me about the process of helping unfold your memories of this. And again, this idea, the problem with the lookup, I think your mother and you didn't look things up. You sort of had your memories, and that's the way it was supposed to be, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. The internet changes everything. I mean, I don't think I'm the first to realize that. But back in the day where you would have like your authority figures that you would go to give you some information about something, you go to like the record store guy or you would go to the video store guy, and they would tell you how to get a movie or what the name of a song was. And the process was so complicated that you tended to remember those things, I think. And I'm a little bit invested in that process that now I look something up and I look at it, and then 10 seconds later, I've forgotten what it was and I look again. And I was having this happen around like trying to figure out like literally logistics of my town. And like I would think I remembered where a bridge was or what a body of water was or some things like that around the town. I would look them up, and they weren't where I thought they were, or I was confused about when I had been there, or I would learn that, like, an ice cream shop that I thought was going at a certain period in time was closed before that. And in that process, I'm also learning, like, oh, this television program that I remember watching didn't exist, or it didn't exist in the way that I remember it. And those things are really disconcerting. I think it's pretty common for all of us with our memories that we slightly change things, or we rearrange things, or if something was really, like, kind of traumatic, you might place it closer in time to another kind of trauma, just because that's the way the mind does things. And so looking things up would just cause me to feel like I often just didn't know if I could remember anything or trust anything. So it is like a kind of a tense process. But like eventually, you know, the thing that was great for me is that I had a brother who still lives in Oklahoma and still lives in our hometown and still lives like actually next door to the place that we grew up in. And so he and I together could kind of collectively put those pieces into place. And then he could say, he's like a little bit older than me. He's like 10 years older than me. He could say, oh, the reason that that looks like that or that you remember it like this is because it moved from this place to that place or something like that.
Yeah. And your brother does play this really interesting role in the memoir, because at the very beginning of the book, he's like, you know, the normal big brother, little sister sort of relationship that you read many, many times. But as the book goes on, his role in the book changes. And it begins with a chapter called Dislocation Relocation. And that whole marks a complete change in the book in my mind. And it starts again with television. You write about the rural purge on television. This is when Green Acres and Hee Haw and all these shows that were set in rural areas just disappeared. And all of a sudden it was urban and gritty and more issues, even in your comedy. And you write about the sort of trauma for you and your family as all of these familiar shows, just as especially as a 5 or 6 year old, how this all disappeared. And then your television is gone, then your father is gone for periods of time, and then it made all this laughter that comes early in the book become clear, and all this uneasiness behind the laughter it becomes clear during this section.
Yeah, so the rural purge is very real. That's one of the things that when I looked it up, I was like, how can this actually be happening? Or how did it happen? It's not that I don't understand why people wanted not to, you know, look at Green Acres or the Beverly Hillbillies. There are a lot of problems with those representations of people who come from places like we come from. But at the same time, when you're a kid, you haven't, like, worked out that kind of critique. My mother certainly had, but I hadn't. And then everything was just kind of gone. And then it was replaced by things like Hill Street Blues, which I also loved and watched growing up. But as you say, yeah, it goes more urban. It goes more to like sort of like policing was very popular. That was like right. One form. And then the other like really dominant form of show were these like very, very rich families that had dynasties like Dynasty or Falcon Crest or Dallas, which was like the closest thing to a kind of rural community. But now like oil barons, which I didn't know personally any oil barons growing up in Oklahoma, but I know that they were there, but I just didn't see that type of personality. So it was really hard. It was really like a kind of moment in time where you're trying to figure out where those people went. I mean, I think working class, like truck driving narratives like BJ and the Bear and Smokey and the Bandit were other things that were like part of that period for me too, and they kind of just were replaced with these stories of these wealthy families like that had very different problems than the problems that the people around me had. So that was kind of a tough time. And I think that like the fact that it's just like a coincidence that coincided with this period in time when my dad also had a stroke. He had a stroke really early in life and he did survive that stroke, but it was pretty touch and go during that period if he would survive that. And so that was really the thing that really threw the family into turmoil.
And it also comes at a time when your father is thinking of leaving your mother too.
Yes, everything happened all at once. It's like, what do they say, things come in threes or something, but I think it came in like 20 or 30 things for my family in the year 1980. But yeah, my dad had his eye on a different life, and the possibility for that was in front of him, and he tried to take it, and the stroke coincided with that moment in time, and it returned him back into our home, and it was this it's this thing that I still think about as like the greatest tragedy and the greatest miracle kind of growing up, is that he didn't get to have maybe that life that he saw coming, but we got him back, you know. And it's like one of these things that I've had to think about for a really long time about how, what that sacrifice might have felt like to him, you know.
Right. And as I mentioned, your brother's role in the book also changes from this older sibling that, you know, is the typical, you know, younger sister, older brother, sibling relationship, to someone who you realize his eyes were wide open to the family dynamic. And it explains a lot about how you depict him in the early part of the book. Again, it sort of is that underlying current that sort of gives you a little uneasiness as you're laughing your head off at some, at parts of the book.
Oh, I'm so glad that you laughed at it. I mean, like, the really,
oh, I laughed
what
out loud.
To do was be able to bring the comedy into these kinds of like darker moments. You know, my brother was, I think partly what happened in our family is our parents did a little bit of a divide and conquer on us. And we didn't have a really great relationship when we were kids, because my brother was like super close to my mother and I was sort of fixated on my father, and it drove a wedge to some degrees with us. And it was only later in life that we started to become close. And the process of doing this book was like a huge process for me in terms of like remembering how my brother was. And my brother was like the voice of sensibility. He was kind of the parent a lot of times at moments when my parents were sort of more focused on their own thing. And there are a number of like really crystal memories in my mind of like when things were going a little bit wrong for me, like when I'm like trying to lift a table and it falls on me and then they're going to have to take me to an emergency room type of situation. My brother would have been the one who was saying, "She's hurt. We have to do something. Let's get this show on the road." He was really the voice of reason in those moments.
I was struck by something early in the book where your mother wanted to take you to Raiders of the Lost Ark when you were 4 or 5, and he's saying, "Don't take her to Raiders of the Lost Ark. She'll freak out." And you were prone to sort of these little meltdowns, and sure enough, to this day, you don't like Nazis or biblical artifacts.
No, absolutely not. My mother didn't have a lot of, she didn't have a huge social group. And so I was kind of like the friend that she would take along to see movies with her. And when I was 5 and 6, she would take me to see anything that she thought was fine. And that included a lot of movies that were just not fine for a 5-year-old, I think. And so, I mean, Raiders is sort of the least of it. The Elephant Man was really the trauma one, where my brother said, "Do not make her sit through this." He went to see some like Bo Derek movie, I think. But my mother made me sit through it, and I was like freaking out, and she didn't want to leave because she wanted to see the end of the movie. And, you know, it's a really great movie. I understand what she was thinking in that moment, but it was not good for me. And Raiders is the same thing. It's like one of my favorite movies from that period. I really love that movie. But yeah, when those faces melt, it was too much for me. It was way too much.
My guest today is Joanna Howard. She teaches creative writing at Denver University, and her new book is titled Rerun Era or The Dislocation. It's published by McSweeney's. And the dislocation that you write about after your father had a stroke, you went to live with another person for almost, it seemed like a year. Now, it might not have been a year. I mean, a 5-year-old can conflate things. And you know, what's interesting is that was pretty common during that time, especially in Oklahoma, in rural. I remember I had an incident in my own life like that where I had to live with someone else, and it was pretty accepted at that particular time. And it's how unusual and so mind-boggling in the way we think things today.
I know. I mean, part of that thing I was saying about how there wasn't a lot of oversight and we could just kind of run around, that made it very fun. There was also this piece where there was just this assumption that you could just be sort of passed around to some other place and it would be totally fine. And I mean, in many regards, it was. I stayed with a neighbor who was a lovely, lovely person, and she was amazing, but it was very disorienting. And I was probably like 3 or 4 blocks from my actual house, and I knew my brother was staying there by himself, and he was like 15 or something. During this period of time, they just decided to let him live in the house. And my mother would kind of come and go. She would appear, you know, maybe once across the day, but my father was in this intensive care situation and then later in a rehabilitation situation. And so she was mostly in Joplin in the hospital during this period. And yeah, we just, you know, we were just doing what we were doing. And during that time, my brother kind of disappeared from everything, from the world. And I was with this, you know, really quite lovely neighbor, friend of the family, but someone who was older and who did things differently and ate differently and frankly had just like a lot more discipline and structure in her life than I had in my own family. And so that was a bit of a shock. I mean, she would do things like say, like, we're going to eat at these times and then we're going to go to bed at this time. And I was like, what is happening? I have to go to bed? This is crazy.
What did you learn in the course of writing this book? Again, I have a feeling in many ways you're taking these little flashbacks and creating the scene, or did you help flesh them out with the help of your brother, who you dedicate the book to, or what exactly?
I think I learned to feel a little bit softer about my family, which was an important goal for me, because I think when you experience like kind of traumatic things in childhood, there's a way that we hold on to them and think like, how could people have let this happen around us? And, you know, like the situations in my family, my parents didn't have a whole lot of choices, I think, about how they could live in the world. My dad's job was his job. The money that he made was what we had, and there wasn't much beyond that. And so, you know, some of the choices that I think that they made because they didn't really have a lot of other options. My dad had like kind of crazy working hours. And so the presence and absence of him was like something that like I wanted to work out. So I think that was really great. And I think that also just like learning what was important to my brother about that period was hugely valuable to me, because we focused on different things. And because we had different memories of different things, we wanted to sort of figure that out. And after the book came out, and he's been so incredibly supportive, I was really nervous about it, because when you depict someone in a book and you depict them, I think I was trying to capture kind of like his vulnerability, but also his sort of heroism to me in those periods. And he was really pleased with the depiction. And that's the thing that makes me happiest about the project as a whole.
Well, as you can well expect, a 5-year-old is going to think, you know, the world literally does revolve around themselves. How did your brother's vision differ?
I think my brother felt that he was invisible during that period of time, because he was just at that age where, especially for my dad's generation, he was basically, he should be a man, he should be doing his own thing, he should be able to cope completely. And my brother was still pretty young. I mean, 15 is not necessarily the age that you're ready to just live on your own and deal with what seems like a family that's kind of in collapse and like a father who may be dying. And so I think that it was a great deal of pressure was put on my brother during that period that nobody really realized that he was perhaps a little too young to be dealing with. And so I think he does feel that he was invisible, and what was going on with him was overlooked. And so I wanted to make him very visible. That was sort of the task.
The name of the book is Rerun Era or The Dislocation. It's published by McSweeney's. Joanna, thanks very much for joining us. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Writer and former Oklahoman Joanna Howard speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She currently teaches creative writing at Denver University and is the author of Rerun Era or The Dislocation. It's published by McSweeney's. She'll be in Tulsa this Monday evening at 7 o'clock to discuss her book in a Magic City BookSmart Tulsa event at Duet Restaurant and Jazz Club. For more information, visit magiccitybooks.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.